Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support. If you're a business owner and you want to increase your cash flow, or if you're a label or artist and you want to promote new music, then listen up. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area, in Hillsborough, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I've got one of the top guitar players in Nashville, and he's held that spot a long time, and says a lot. And we're with Johnny Garcia today. And before we get rolling, I want to thank our mutual friend Jeff King for connecting us a while back. Johnny's a guitarist, producer, and publisher from South Texas. He arrived in Nashville in June of 91 to audition as a lead guitarist for Trisha Yearwood at the onset of her career, and he earned the position after 5 days of grueling tryouts. A year later, he was promoted to music director and band leader from all of her touring and television performances all over the world, and he still holds that position. It's like 30 years later, almost 28 years later, 28 years later. Yeah, man, that's like 150 years in music world, right? He was then hired by Garth Brooks as Garth's lead guitarist in 2000, and he still tours with Garth all over the world. Beyond his successes as a Nashville guitarist and a music director, Johnny's also ventured into other facets of the music industry as a publisher, record producer, studio musician, and a songwriter. Other artists he's played and toured with include Joe Nichols, Colin Ray, Susan Ashton, George Jones, Tanya Tucker, B.B. King, Lee Bryce, Steve Wariner, who we had on this show, Huey Lewis, Billy Joel, Kelsey Ballerini, Don Henley, Jackson Browne, and Bonnie Raitt. Man, what a list. Johnny has 11 writers under contract working for his publishing companies with publishing cuts for artists including Jason Aldean, Parmalee, Trace Atkins, Brett Eldridge, Radio Romance, Alabama, and many others. And he's got producer credits for over a dozen artists, including Colin Ray, Sherry Austin, and Gary P. Nunn. He's got recording credits, obviously, for Trisha and Garth, but also Colin Ray, Sherry Austin, Martina McBride, Susan Ashton, Alabama, Jesse James, and others. And from a TV standpoint, he's pretty much been everywhere, including the ACMs, the CMAs, The Tonight Show, David Letterman, Good Morning America, The Today Show, Regis and Kathy Lee, Ellen, The View, Fox and Friends, SNL, various NBC specials, Jimmy Kimmel, and everybody else. Johnny, thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, man, you're so welcome, dude. It's all my pleasure, bro.
Man, so 28 years ago, you moved to Nashville. What made you move there, and how'd you get the audition with Trisha?
A couple of friends of mine from Texas, David Lewis was one of them, bass player, songwriter guy, and also a guy named Craig Langford. I played with them in a couple of bands down there, man, some really, really good bands. And they moved to Nashville, I want to say around 87, 88. And they both, especially David Lewis, became quite successful. But Craig Langford, it was a bass player as well. They were both bass players. He would call me, and he would he would say, "Hey man, do you want to audition for whoever was hot at that point, right? It'd be Ronnie Millsap or Reba or anybody that was, you know, a big name at that point." He'd call me and he says, "You want to audition?" And I said, "Nah, man." I said, "I'm good. You know, I was down in South Texas and I owned an electric company. I'm a master electrician, by the way."
Holy shit. Dude, you remind me of like, remember In Living Color?
Yeah.
One job. Wow.
Yeah, man, and I played with some amazing bands down there and stuff, rock stuff and country stuff as well. And so I was telling, man, I'm good, man. You know, I'm happy. My company's doing great, and you know, I get to play with incredible players down here and make really good money down here and stuff. And one night he called me. It was Sunday night. I had just gotten a cell phone in my truck, and there were these giant things, right, that they would anchor into the floorboard of your truck, and then you had like a 10-foot antenna sticking out.
I remember that, man.
And Craig was one of the few guys that had my number, because I think it was like $3 a minute or something to talk on those things back then. And he called me on a Sunday night. I was sitting on my driveway outside my house. It was like 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. And the Houston Astros were playing the Cincinnati Reds. I was a big Astros fan growing up. And I was listening to the end of the game on AM radio, right? In the truck. And he called and he says, "You want to audition for Trisha Yearwood?" And I'm going, "Who is that, dude?" He says, "What do you mean, who's that? She's got the number one song in America. Don't you listen to country?" I said, "No, not really. No." You know, I listen to AM radio to listen to the Astros, and then I listen to talk radio, you know, because I became a conservative-minded fella at a young age. And other than that, I said, "If I'm listening to FM, I listen to rock stations, man." And he says, "I can't believe you don't know who this is," but he had gotten the bass playing slot. And they had already auditioned 3 days of guitar players. So the whole band was intact. You know, every piece was intact, except the lead guitar guy. She didn't like anybody in 3 days. And then so they were going to have another 2 days in about a week from then was the story. And so we hung up. You know, he was actually kind of pissed off at me because he would keep telling me that I was wasting my talents and that I could get a job for any, you know, with anybody and all this stuff, you know, and said, "Hey, I'm happy, dude. You know, bug off." Listening to the game. We pulled it off. I think it was 3-2 at the end there. Went inside the house and I had a late dinner with my wife there. And, then I got in my truck the next morning to go to work to my office. And not only was my radio on FM as when I turned the truck on, but that song was playing, "She's in Love with a Boy," that he was talking about.
Wow.
And
I
outside on the side of the road there by my house, and I just listened to this song, and I just kind of had chills all over me, man. And something, it was kind of like, you know, I'm a real spiritual cat, man, so it's kind of like some sort of calling for me. So I called him right there then at 6 a.m. and woke him up. And he says, "Damn it, man, what the hell are you doing calling me at 6 a.m.? I'm a musician." And I said, "I'm in, man. Tell me what I need to do." So he called me later that day, and it was complicated. Back then, they FedExed me a tape that got lost and got delivered to the wrong place. And I ended up not really knowing the songs before I came to Nashville because the tape was like 6 days late. Cassette tape, you know, and I could say, "Well, send me an MP3, man." You know,
yeah, man. Anyway, just to let you know, when you told me that, I got goosebumps myself. So I could totally get it. That, you know, this is like the universe speaking to me, man. How you probably felt. So yeah,
check this out, dude. So I had them FedEx the tape to my mother's house. My dad had just passed a few years before that, so my mom was by herself there. Back then, you had to sign for FedEx, right?
Hmm.
So I didn't have them ship it to my office just in case none of us were there. And so, you know, so on Tuesday, this was on Monday, on Tuesday, I came by my mom's house afterwards to say, "Hey, Mom, did you get a FedEx package from Nashville, Tennessee?" She said, "No, son, I sure didn't." Wednesday evening, again, I came by, nothing, right? So I called Nashville and I said, "Did you guys send a tape?" "Yeah. You know, call this number. There's a tracking number." So I call FedEx and they say, Yeah, Johnny Garcia signed for the FedEx package on Tuesday at 10:12 a.m. or something like that. I said, no, man, he didn't sign. Yes, you did. I said, wait a second, dude. I'm Johnny Garcia. I didn't think, yes, you did. So it just, you know, we kind of ran into a wall there and stuff. And so I asked him to please send me another one. Now it's Thursday, right after they're, because they're rehearsing. They're about to start opening for Garth in a week. So now it's Thursday, right after rehearsals, they're going to run and drop another tape for me to get on Friday. And they missed the deadline. And so I'm screwed, right? It's like, oh, no. It's like they didn't deliver on Saturdays back then. But I end up finding, my mom says, go look around the neighborhood. Maybe somebody else got it. And they're right across the street, the single mama and a little boy were just moved in there. And the little boy's name was Johnny Garcia, and he signed for it.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
And the little dude wouldn't give it to me, man. He's like, hey, it's my tape. And he actually tried to attack me at his little house there. And he wouldn't cough it up. His little friend finally found it inside his pillowcase, man. That's how dear it was. The tape was for him. So I made a copy of it real quick, and I could hear him screaming across the street, man. Oh, my gosh. But anyway, that's how it started, though. And so I came to audition and walked in the room, you know, and the whole band's in there, and Trisha and Garth Fundus, who's her producer, you know, lifelong producer pretty much. And I think I scared the shit out of everybody, because apparently back then I used to look like a murderer or something, everybody. Look mean as hell, man. I thought I was the nicest guy in the world. But anyway, I think the first song, I actually played the wrong intro for the first song. I played the intro to another song that was on E-flat as well. And so, you know, I said, oh, man, I'm toast. And I finished it. I corrected myself. And at the end of the song, I said, hey, I know I played the wrong intro. If you guys want to hear the right one, I'll be glad to give it to you. And Trisha said, like, no, man, that's cool. So we played, it was six songs. You know, I left, and it was at 8 in the morning. And then they were auditioning guitar players the rest of the day, every 30 minutes. And then the next day, they were doing again, every 30 minutes, different guys. So at the end, they couldn't make up their mind between me and this guy named Kenny Kramer, who's an awesome guitar player, man, great friend of mine. Trisha wanted me, Garth Fundus wanted Kenny Kramer. And the band wanted me too, but Trisha was looking for a sound, and apparently I had that sound. I didn't sound at all like a Nashville kind of dude, you know, and maybe that's what she was looking for, I guess. I don't know. So me and Kenny Kramer auditioned again that night on Tuesday, like at 8 p.m., but now they gave us 45 minutes each. But when I get back to the rehearsal hall, he was there, but the band or Trisha or nobody was there. They were out having dinner. And I rented an amp from there. It was a Fender Twin that I think they were the worst amps in the world to begin with. And this one was really bad. And Kenny Kramer had like this amazing 69 Blackface Super Twin, man. I mean, super. And he says, man, you know, plug in if you like my rig, dude. And I played an E chord on it with my Strat, and it's the nicest E chord I ever sounded. So he let me use his rig. And so then the band came in and so forth. I went first, and then you had 15 minutes to do whatever you wanted to do. And I chose to do some instrumental stuff that was just real melodic, more ballady kind of thing. And so they end up giving me the job. Well, actually, you know, Garth Fundus calls me at midnight after those second auditions, right? And he says, man, he says, you know, Trisha's going to be opening for Garth in front of 25,000 people in 2 days. And we're afraid that since you have no major league experience, that you might freak out or get nervous or choke or something. And I said, man, I was born and raised 4 miles north of the Mexican border in South Texas, and I'm used to people shooting at me. Go by my house right now. My mama's house is riddled with bullet holes in the front of it, unfortunately. And I said, and you think I'm going to be scared of people cheering for me, man?
Yeah, yeah, right.
And he says, man, you got the gig. And so, and 2 days later, I was on the road opening for Garth, right? And that's how me and Garth met, obviously, you know. But so I just came to audition. I really didn't move to Nashville and then look for a job. I came to audition for her and end up on the road, you know, just a couple of days later.
That's amazing, man. So what was, like, what was your, were you, I'm assuming you were married at the time, or? Were you single? And
right there at that point, I was actually transitioning. I was going through a divorce at that point.
Okay.
First wife of 10 years, exactly to the day. It was one of those deals early on where, man, you know, I had this one-night stand with this chick and got her pregnant, and my dad told me, you're going to marry that girl for 10 years. He's like, there will be no bastard Garcia babies. And blah, blah. You know, you're going to raise that child, boy, and teach him how to be like you and me. And then he says, and after 10 years, if you're still not in love with this lady, you can go ahead and get divorced. So at 10 years.
Wow, you took that quite literally.
Yeah, and after he told me that, unfortunately, he passed away. So
Sorry.
I did exactly what he told me to do, man. That's the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, very cool.
And the oldest boy, man, we were so tight. It's awesome. So, and then now with three other kids as well. So I got a total of four.
So the job came at like a good time for you emotionally, because like you're splitting and now you can kind of like figure out what you want to be when you grow up, you know, and who you want to be when you, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was a good moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good era in my past, you know. It was good to get out of there as well, you know. And then for my son was 10 at that point, and so I would bring him up to Nashville a lot. Then he also went to school in Nashville for a year as well when he was in high school and stuff. So, and then I'd bring him touring with me all the time, you know, kind of thing. And then as he grew up, when he started going to college and stuff, he also started touring with me, and he became our stage manager and so forth. And he stole all my groupies.
Well, that's cool, man. Great story, man. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Really cool how that came about. When you did have that first gig, was it weird? Like, 'cause you had never played. What was the, like, What range of emotions were going through you when you're
the very first show with her?
Yeah, when you first step out on stage.
What was it? Deer Creek Amphitheater, I think it's somewhere in Indiana, I believe. Man, you know, I remember feeling right at home. I remember feeling like I was in my living room.
Great. And
to this day, when I play with Garth, especially, you know, he loves arenas, you know, just because it just feels like a tiny little place, and we can see everybody in the eye and connect with everybody. You know, I know that's crazy because those things are freaking huge, right? But no, it never. I just remember just looking out into the crowd and going, "Wow, this is cool." But never felt a bit of nervousness or none of that stuff. I mean, and you know, I've always been a real kind of emotional player, so you know, it's just immediately I was. Okay, so when you play for this big of a crowd, I have to be able to play my guitar and make everybody here at least feel something.
Hmm.
You know, David Gilmour School, man, I think, when he does his thing with Pink Floyd, he is the best guitar player in history to reach out to big audiences. You know, you listen to him in a stadium and you hear the solo, let him play the solo for, you know, Comfortably Numb or something, and it's like, man, he grabs everybody. So I kind of, from a young age, I kind of learned a lot from him, you know, and especially it was very helpful when I started playing in huge, big big audiences, you know.
He is literally my favorite guitar player, so I feel you on that, man. Yeah. He's amazing. So we started talking about this a little bit before we started recording. You're like literally the first player I've met who runs a publishing company that you employ writers. Well, not first, one of a few. What prompted you to get into that?
You know, I've always kind of been a business head kind of guy. You know, I had my own company, my own electric company. I think I was 23. I got my master's in electricity early on. And I've always kind of just diversified, man. I mean, guitar is my first love, obviously, you know. You know, driving down Music Row here on 17th and 16th Avenues here in town, you know, as a young man here that just started with Trisha, you know, I go driving down those two lanes there and see all these Jaguars and, you know, Mercedes and all this stuff. And I'm like, who the hell owns these kind of vehicles? And they're going, oh, they're all publishers, maybe some managers. Publishers, what the hell is a publisher? You know, and so I started educating myself on what that whole process is, you know, and basically a publisher here in Nashville. A song is like a book. You know, you can't buy a book unless it's published by a publisher, right? The same thing with music. You can't stream it or buy it or download it or get a hard copy of it unless it's published by someone. And that's what I was really fascinated by that industry. And me and some business partners opened up a company. And, you know, what you do is you employ professional songwriters and you put them in rooms with artists that are signed to record labels or other writers that are signed to other publishers or so forth. And then you pitch these songs to either the producers or the artists themselves, kind of thing, you know. And then, you know, if in country, you know, if airplay still pays a lot of money, or it's also called performance royalties. Then you got your mechanical royalties. That's for sales of all kinds, or sync licenses. That's for TV and film. But anyway, you know, a song still in country that gets to number one, and if it stays there for 2 weeks, man, it almost averages right at $900,000 to $1 million just in airplay. So it's a lucrative business if you're smart about it, and you know, you don't go spend $500,000 a year on cocaine, you know, because that's most people who fail around here. That's what they do.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't mess around with any of that stuff. So it's all been a good thing, man. You know, within publishing companies, you also develop young artists as well, kind of thing. You know, you get them under your wing and you put them in writing rooms with top writers, and then next thing you know, you're cutting a record for them, producing a record for them, and hopefully get a record deal on them. So anyway, that's what that business is about, you know. So it's and you have a building, and you have it's there's several writing rooms. That's all they're for, you know, for writers to go in and to write. And then you have small studios in each one of those rooms, so that they can record their idea when they get done writing, right? And usually most of them have a little bit of savvy on how to record, at least, you know, at least to get in trouble with Pro Tools or something, but at least lay the idea down, kind of thing.
Sure.
Then if it merits a full-blown demo after that, then you do a full-blown demo with best players in town, or you do a scaled-down demo with just acoustic guitars or something. But I love that business, and I'm still in it and plan to be in that sort of business, you know, forever.
Let me ask you this, man. Where did all this like drive come from? You got your master's, you hustled and started your own company, you got a bunch of different stuff going on here. So why? Like, where did that come from? How did that get instilled in you? And what do you get out of that? What do you get out of it besides the extra income, like to keep, because you're clearly a hustler. So
yeah,
where does that come from?
Man, it definitely came from my father, man, growing up. I grew up very poor, man. I was a migrant farm laborer. For the first 18 years of my life, I picked every crop that you can imagine. You name it, and I have picked that crop. You know, so I used to work in the fields, cotton fields, potato fields, you name it, man. And I did that from early April through the end of November, usually. And we would migrate around, you know, to Alabama and did potato crops. Late in August, we'd go to Ohio or Indiana, did tomato crops there, and Michigan to do the apple crop even after that, and until it started freezing everywhere, then it was time to go back to Texas, right? But during those years, man, my daddy, man, there was no such thing as a lazy kid, man. That wasn't an option, you know? I mean, he was an amazing man. Like I was saying earlier, I lost him when I was 20 years old, man, which was... my world turned upside down when that happened, because it was sudden. But he taught me so much about the work ethic and how important it is to be a hardworking man, and how you don't loaf. And man, you're going to take care of your family, you know, your kids. You're not ever going to take a handout. You're not ever going to let anybody give you nothing. You're going to earn everything, you know. So he was, that's the way he functioned. And so without even, I mean, he used to tell me and my two brothers that, but just watching him do his thing, I just became him.
Yeah.
And so, man, that's where my work ethic came from, man. And also, you know, if you're a musician in Nashville, even if you have a pretty decent gig, man, touring, you know, you're going to get by. You're never, you know, going to be like, oh, man, you know, I'm going to be able to retire at some point, you know, because, you know, you're lucky to make 40, 50 grand a year, right? Now, I must say this, that I'm very, very fortunate because my two bosses, which is Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood, are very, very generous. And for a long time, they've super taken care of my family. But I'm just talking about, you know, your average example, sure. Right? So you always have to do something, you know, if you're just a musician here, you have to do something to supplement, right? And so that's why, you know, early on, especially I was going to diversify and do other things as well, kind of thing. Even though I must say to the audience that if all I did was play guitar, I've done incredibly if we're talking financial, you know. It's been great, man. But I'm just a freaking workaholic, I guess it's it, you know.
Let me ask you this. When you grow up without money and in that mindset and in that arena, it's often difficult to then say, because I grew up, I wasn't a migrant worker, but I grew up in a financially good situation and with people that were, you know, of that mindset of that's the way life is. It's often hard to make that leap to say, okay, you know, life doesn't have to be this way. I can get a professional job. I can get a career. I can become an electrician. Did you ever have any, like, not issues, but how did you make that leap? Did you find it hard, or did you ever have any, like, you know, the little guy on this shoulder talking to you, said, what are you doing? You're not an electrician. You're a migrant farm worker. It's hard to change your identity. At least it was for me, and it's hard for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. I mean, one thing that was really important for me is to graduate from high school because none of my relatives ever did. Hmm. My older brothers didn't, you know, because everybody was in the crops in the fields, right? Sure. But I would come back to Texas and I'd go to school for 3 months or 4 months, whatever I could, right? And I end up graduating from high school, right? And that was a big moment for the Garcia family.
Sure.
Also the Rivera family, which is my mama's side, right? Because, man, my aunts and uncles, the more kids that they had, the more kids they could take to the crops and the more money they would make. So,
sure.
And they were busy making babies. Holy shit, man. But, so when I graduated from high school, you know, my dad says, he says, son, I'm supposed to tell you to go to college, you know, go be a doctor or a lawyer. Or he said, or hell, be the next president of the United States of America. He says, but the hell with it. He says, go be a guitar player. You're going to be a rock star someday.
Wow.
Oh, man. Okay. Yeah. Cool. I did end up going to college. It was after he passed when I met my wife, now Lori Garcia, who is my world, man. She says, you know what, man? I want to marry you, but I'm not going to marry a dumbass. You need to go to college. So I went to college, man. But for me, though, I'm not afraid to take any risks whatsoever. You know, I'm very smart about it, right? Yeah. I mean, for instance, I'm also a carpenter, man. I built most of the house that I live in right now. I built this entire studio pretty much. And so, you know, if I build a new house and it's not leveled and plumb, I tear it down and build it again,
sure.
You know, until I get it right. And so I never give up on anything. And if I like an idea, you know, man, it's just once I decide I'm going to do it, I do it, man. I have no fear whatsoever, you know. I mean, I don't want to lose my ass on something or something, you know, but I'm smart about it, and I love taking chances, man. I think, you know, pushing things to the edge, you know, I mean, and what better example than Garth Brooks to push things to the edge, right? I mean, and I also surround myself with good people, man.
That's what I was about to say. It sounds like you attract, and like between your dad, your wife, Garth. It sounds like you've,
These are amazing people, man. Yeah. How humble like Garth is and how humble Trisha is. It's just absolutely beautiful, man. I mean, it's, you know, if you meet Garth for the first time, you can't get him to say one damn thing about himself. All he wants to know is about you, you know, and Trisha's the same way, you know. They're just great people, man, and they're very loyal, too, and which is I'm crazy loyal, man, when, and, you know, I'm also one of those people that if I do something well for myself, there's going to be people around me that are going to do well because of it, too. And I have friends that think that way too, as in Garth and Trisha, right? And so I just, you know, for that reason too, man, I venture into some things, you know, and I've actually never done a stupid deal, thank God, you know, because I do a lot of research and stuff. Yeah. You know? I'm venturing into possibly being ahead of a record label coming up here later this year. And for the I've done so much data research and statistics and educated myself so much about that world and how it functions, you know, in order for me to be the best at it and stuff. So yeah, once it's like guitar as well. You know, when I started playing as a kid, for some reason, man, even at the age, by the age of 12, 13, I was already playing in bars. But at that point, for some reason, I knew that I was going to be doing what I do right now. It's crazy. And I never tell anybody, right? Hey, man, I'm going to be lead guitar player for the biggest entertainer in the world. No, I never said a word to anybody. But I knew that that was coming in the pipeline, you know, like kind of like God had put his, you know, he put this in my schematic or in my blueprint, you know, maybe 1,000 years ago. And
right.
I believe that, like every member in Garth's band, is feels the same way, man. It's just we're just kind of vessels delivering what the big man up there wants us to deliver, you know. Because there's something else going on in that stage, bro. That's of another plane or another existence. There's some heavy stuff going up in that stage, man.
That's cool, man.
Man, it's all fantastic, you know. But with that said, though, I mean, yeah, maybe this is what you were destined to do, but you also got to work your ass off.
Right.
You know, I'm not one of those guys, oh, man, here, you're going to go do this. No, you're going to be the best at it, you know. And even in my years as a migrant farm laborer, we lived in little 10 by 10, you know, shacks. No electricity, you know. I mean, forget about running water and all that kind of stuff, right? You know, but my dad was a guitar player as well, and so were my older brother.
Okay.
So we had a guitar everywhere we went. And so we were playing forever, man. I mean, all the time. If we had electricity, my dad would let me learn like a song on a record player. You know, I had to be in bed by 8:30. But he'd let me, right after supper, he'd let me work on a song kind of thing. So, yeah. A lot of studying, oh man, millions of hours of freaking studying, and it's still going on, you know.
Sure.
The thing.
That's good. Thank you, man, for sharing that. It sounds like you had some really, really good habits instilled in you by your dad, man, as far as how to approach something, how to, you know, have the discipline to attack something, to commit to something, to think things through before making a decision. Those are great coping skills that very few people really are allowed to, I get, you know, from somebody. That's kind of the shit you got to learn on your own the hard way. So that's awesome, man.
Yeah, he completely paved my path, man. As a person, as a worker, as a musician, and then to losing him at the age of 20, and then he got the flu all of a sudden, and he one of those guys that never go to the doctor, you know, and I saw him in bed for 2 days, and he was just like the most macho dude, man, ever, you know. He was like a freaking brick wall, you know. And I'm going, Dad, man, you don't look right, dude. I'm going to take you to the doctor. And he had to say, and he'd say, boy, I don't go to the doctor unless I got gonorrhea.
Okay.
Well, Dad, I said, if you ever catch that shit, I know you didn't catch it from my mama, man.
Yeah.
So anyway, we did take him to the doctor, and it was too late, man. He had pneumonia and didn't make it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but yeah, man, he just
It gave you a lot of gifts, man. I'll tell you right now.
And man, I'll share this one with you. It's when he died, you know, at funeral, and he was in a veterans hospital because he went to Korea, but he was in a veteran hospital in San Antonio, which was 4 hours north of where we grew up. And we were all over there, you know, we followed the ambulance, and then we were there for a couple of days. And then the doctor at the hospital finally says, man, you know what? He's going to be all right. He's got it now. You know, and my dad said, hey, man, go back to work. Oh, by the way, I was managing a hardware store at that time. He says, yeah, son. He says, go back to work, man. So I left about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I think it was on the third day, maybe. Came home, and he didn't make it through that night. He took a bad turn, obviously, but he woke my mama up, man. And my brother, oldest brother, Simon, they were sitting in chairs asleep, you know, in the hospital room. And he woke them both up and he says, hey, tell little Johnny not to ever quit playing. He's going to be a rock star someday. And he closed his eyes and he died.
Holy shit.
I didn't know this. My mom told me this, you know, like a three weeks later after that. You know, that's the last thing he said. He woke us up to tell us that.
Wow, that's heavy, man.
And so then I saw my oldest brother later in the day. I said, hey, man, what's the last thing my dad said? And he told me exactly the same thing, right? My dad was really proud, right, because he thought that I was quite gifted. And, you know, we were all guitar players, my brothers and him himself. My dad was an awesome guitar player. And so, you know, fast forward, man, to about a year and a half ago. We're playing at Yankee Stadium with Garth. And it's going to be televised all over the place and so forth. The whole show is. A couple of weeks before the show, Garth comes up to me and he says, hey, man, he said, I want you to start Yankee Stadium by yourself. He says, no Garth, no band, just you. And I said, I ain't scared. What do you want? He said, man, Star Spangled Banner. A la Jimi Hendrix.
Holy smoke. That's so cool.
And he says, and behind you, there's going to be 100 wide video screens all over the place with American flags flying and blah, blah, blah. Just you, man. I said, rock it on. All right. So I said, oh, damn, I better start working on a cool version of this thing, right? So when we get to Yankee Stadium, it was raining, man, all the time we were there. We did three nights, about two shows. And so I go to the lights out at Yankee Stadium, right? Complete lights out, all the audience lights and all the stage lights. And I find myself to the center of front, at the very front of the stage. There's a white X with gaff tape. You know, that's where I need to find it and go stand there. And right underneath me, about 10 feet below, you know, on the ground is guys with headsets. And when I'm ready, I give them a thumbs up. And then every spotlight at Yankee Stadium just zooms in, right? And everything's still dark except for the spotlights. And I tear into it, kind of thing. And but I took a second or, you know, a few seconds to just absorb and reflect and look all around the audience. You know, just kind of take it in, right? And then for some reason, I felt compelled to look beyond the seats in the back. And my dad was there, and that's the moment he was talking about right before he passed.
You felt like his spirit with you right there.
I actually saw his image right over the seats.
Wow.
And I just looked at him and I gave him a thumbs up because I just gave him a thumbs up, right? And I said, this is what you were talking about. But when I gave the thumbs up to him, every single freaking spotlight hit me because that was my
yeah, that was your cue, man.
To the guy right below me, and I'm going, oh shit, I gotta play now. But anyway, man, that's just one of the you know, memory banks of all my career. That was the night, you know. That's
very cool, man. Thank you for sharing. That's great, man. I grew up not far from that Yankee Stadium where you were playing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's why I asked you earlier if you were north,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Yeah, I'm originally from New York City. I'm originally from the Bronx. Yeah, not far from there, man. In fact, the hospital I was born at was real close. Man, is there anything in looking back, if you had to give yourself advice as a younger man, anything you would have told yourself that would have made your life easier? Any personal business, anything?
In the personal situation, again, doing what my dad told me to do was to marry my first that young lady, you know, and raise my first son was best thing I've ever done, right? You know, man, I can honestly say that I wouldn't change anything growing up musically or personally. I will say musically, though, for all the young players up, you know, of today, guitar players, I don't care what it is that you play, emphasize and really focus. Yeah, chops, theory, licks, you know, flying on the fingerboard, that's great and it's all good to know. And it's in, but focus a lot on your rhythm, your feel, you know, because that's what makes people feel good, man. And the emotion behind your playing, you know. So I hear so many players that can play chops forever, but they got no rhythm. Their internal clock is just not good, you know. They rush through this, they rush through that, you know, transitions, you know, and it's just really develop your internal clock and rhythm. I didn't focus on that till I was older, maybe in my, you know, later 20s. I wish I would have done that earlier. Hmm. But yeah, that's the only thing. Other than that, man, it's the ride has been really good.
Very cool, man. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. Okay. What's your go-to guitar, and what other guitars might round out your next few?
Well, the go-to one forever has been a 62 Strat that I still play with Trisha and Garth. That's my main guitar. She's beat up just like I am, you know.
Is that the wooden one?
Yeah.
That's gorgeous, man. How'd you get that guitar? When did you get that guitar?
Actually, I got that guitar when I first came to Nashville from a guy named Bernie Valuti. He did monitors for Trisha briefly, and he just brought this Strat. I think it was in 1992. He brought this Strat to the stage. He says, "Hey, man, you want to play this?" And my jaw dropped.
yeah, twist my arm.
And he sold it to me for, I don't know, $500 or something.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And so that guitar is just like that guitar is sad when I'm sad. That guitar is angry when I'm angry. That guitar is bluesy when I'm bluesy. It's just a part of me, man. It just
awesome.
Cries when I cry and gets pissed off when I'm pissed. So
that's cool. All original pickups and everything?
Original pickups. A couple of the pots are still original, believe it or
not.
It doesn't have the original bridge on it, but that's about it. The rest is, you know, and the finish, obviously.
Sure.
That guy was a Bonnie Raitt fan, and he wanted his guitar to look like Bonnie Raitt, so he sanded the finish down. And
right.
That, you know, I guess it's some sort of a walnut or something. But, yeah, that guitar's been with me. That's been my main workhorse. And I also got a 71 Paul that I standard that I love, absolutely, and also a 71 Tele that are, you know, very close to me kind of thing. I have a lot of guitars, but my sons all play guitar. I have three sons and a daughter, and they all play guitar.
Oh, and they all play guitar. That's like great to be your kid.
Yeah,
if you're a guitar player.
We're here in the studio, and man, one of them is incredible, man. His name is Dante, and he's already cut his own record and engineered it, played drums, bass, key, everything, guitars, and sings great. That's one thing I suck at. I can't sing worth a damn. Sings great. That's but yeah, cool, mainly that 62 Strat is my to go to.
That's such a cool looking. Do you have it handy? Like, do you have it like near you?
Yeah, let me go grab it.
Yeah, this man, I'd love to see it. Thank you. Yeah, man, do you think?
One of these days I'm going to label my cases so I don't have to go through 20 cases.
Wow. Okay, so let me first of all, it is, man, that's so, let me just look it before I describe it. Man, that is gorgeous, dude. Holy smokes. So it's, as Johnny said, the finish has been sanded off, but it's a beautiful, as you said, walnut wood color.
Yeah. right.
It's really not even banged up too bad, man. It's like for a guitar that's 50 years old almost. It's older, yeah. Over 50 years old. I'm sorry. It's 56, 57 years old. So it's got a rosewood neck.
Rosewood neck on it, yeah.
And
well,
it's,
a thing to tell the man,
the
guy who plays Strats, that little guy right there is an Alembic, what do you call it, Stratoblaster? It's like a little boost.
Mm.
Man, it is fantastic. It just adds a little more punch to that single coil kind of thing, you know, and you can turn it on and off if you just want that twangy rhythm, you turn it off. But for solos, you know, man, it really soars when you kick that sucker in, man. It's just that little extra thing, you know. It's really awesome.
And but is that wired to all three pickups or just the
– It is, yeah.
That's mm-hmm. really – so there's a little boost switch on there. And the jack is in the front of the guitar like an SG instead of right. on the bottom, mm-hmm. Probably to work with that switch. It's in great shape, man.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Garth runs into me. He runs about 30 miles an hour on stage and knocks the shit out of his guitar.
Great shape, man. It really is. That's gorgeous, man. That is so cool. Thank you. Man. And it's like a mint. Is that mint green? I can't see exactly. The pick guard?
Oh, well, it used to be white.
Okay,
you know,
so it's just faded. 58
years ago or whenever it was.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
Through the years and, you know, it's just turned like almost green, yellow, something.
And white knobs, white pickups. It's great looking guitar, man. It's just gorgeous.
Thank you, man. This thing is awesome, man. It is fantastic. Been a lot of miles with me.
Thanks for grabbing that, Johnny. I appreciate it. Anybody who influences your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Oh, man. My biggest influence has been Jeff Beck. If you hear me play rock, that it'll come out. You know, oh man, that guy listens to Beck, you know. For playing big arenas and stadiums, definitely where my head goes is Dave Gilmour from Pink Floyd. You know, I guess Hendrix, Gilmour, and Beck, man, are my main influences of all time. Those are my three top guitar players.
Very cool, man. Desert Island Discs.
Ah, man.
Just for today.
Probably Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, yeah. That's,
Probably Blow by Blow by Jeff Beck.
Great record.
And Machine Head, man. Deep Purple. That Richie Blackmore just rocked my world, man, growing up. He also had a lot to do with the way I play.
That's such a great – that's like mm-hmm. – You got to be very similar in age to me. That's the whole thing we grew up on. That could be like the three pillars holding up the stool, man. That's great music, man.
If you're YouTubing, look up. I can't remember the name of it, but Deep Purple played that entire record in a small bar. I think it might have been in Japan before this record came out. And dude, those guys were so on fire in that little tiny club. It was insane. It was, I mean, John Lord on that B3 with a Marshall stack and Richie Blackmore going at it.
Amazing.
Ah, man, I've seen that live thing, you know, and it's some camera up in the front and, you know, just recording live, you know.
Is it under Deep Purple Machine Head or Deep Purple Machine Head Japan or?
I forget what it's under, but it's like, Deep Purple Machine Head at a club, I think. Something like that.
Okay.
You'll find it.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out because I love that album. Man.
Just be ready to sit there for an hour. And you don't want to be disturbed. You don't want to know anything about the world except those guys that were so young. And, man, just the fire coming out of him was unbelievable, man.
Very cool.
And
thank
that's
you.
Before, and that's right before that record came out. It wasn't out yet. So they played. And the guy, who was it? Who was the singer? Ian
Gillan.
Yeah. He says, well, we just recorded this. Nobody's heard. And we just want to see what you think. And then they tore into it.
How cool is that? You imagine awesome. Seeing him come to your little local club playing a whole album?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Nuts, man. All right, man. Let me ask you some heady questions. What's the best decision you ever made, Johnny? Because you made a bunch of good ones.
Marrying that one-night stand girl and raising my son. Definitely.
What did that do for you that you found that it's the best decision?
The most important thing in my life is tight family. It's a close family. My wife, Lori Garcia, and I, we've got three kids, and then we got Chris from my first wife, and Chris and Mateo, Dante, and Mia. They're as close as can be, you know, and it's just awesome. All that matters to me, man, at the end of the day is, you know, after I die and whatever, is how close my family stays.
Yeah.
My wife's side of the family, man, I've never seen a family that's as beautiful as hers. I mean, they're just so, so together, so tight. They talk to each other all the time. And so, yeah, man, that's what's at the top for me.
Very cool. So that allowed you to cultivate that.
Arthur, you know, are at the top too, right?
But, sure. No, but family comes first. I hear you. What are the things you've learned most about yourself throughout this journey you've been on?
That I'm very honest to myself. I'm very honest to people. If something can be done better, I'm always the guy to go get it done better, even when nobody's looking, nobody cares. Attention to detail is very important to me as well. As far as, you know, also is knowing just how to be a good guy in the bus, especially, you know, man, just being a good person, man. You know, caring about people. And I think I'm a fantastic listener when somebody's got a problem or an issue. If it's a friend of mine or an artist I'm working with or whoever, I sit there and listen to them until they get it all of their system and try my best to help them out as best as I can, you know? So, yeah.
Very cool, man. What's your best childhood memory? Sounds like you got a lot of them.
Man, South Alabama. Maybe from the ages of 4 to about 12. Every Wednesday night, missionaries would come to our camps, to our migrant camps, and there was this big magnolia tree in this one particular camp at the front. And we would sit under this magnolia tree, all the kids would, and sing Jesus songs in the evenings with Brother Reed was his name. That is absolutely my best memory, you know, growing up. Is those were such incredible moments for me. Actually, about a year ago, my wife and I drove from Nashville down to South Alabama because I had to find that tree.
The magnolia tree.
Yeah. And I mean, the camp was all gone and stuff, but I ended up finding that magnolia tree. And it was just a, man, I had to go feel it again, you know, kind of thing.
It must have felt good, like not many people that sat around songs singing that tree have taken the journey you have.
Right.
Not from a prideful standpoint, but from a, that you work hard standpoint. It must have felt great.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
Good for you. Good
thing for me as well, you know, I'm a real spiritual cat, man. I'm a, you know, very dedicated Christian cat. And so, and in my life growing up, there was a lot of messages like that, a lot of emotions, you know, that now as I'm older, I want to go back to and find them, you know, kind of thing.
You know, and for people listening who have never been around or seen migrant workers, there's tons of migrant workers in Florida, and it is a incredibly, incredibly difficult life. I mean, it's literally work sun up to sundown
every day. Yeah.
Monday is the same as Tuesday. It's the same as Wednesday. I mean, it is a very difficult life, man. So I give you so much freaking credit to have been able to leave that, to come from that and leave that behind. That is really, from my perspective, a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment, because when you are rooted in a certain mindset, it is very difficult to leave, man. So yeah. a tremendous props to you, bro.
A couple of years ago, we played at Ohio State in Columbus with Garth. We did 2 weeks of shows there. And we had a couple of days off, and I rented a car and drove about 3 hours away to go try to find this little migrant camp that I used to go, that, you know, we used to go there every year to pick in the tomato fields. And again, the camp was gone, right? Because, you know, but I found the spot where it was, you know. And again, I'm visiting areas like that, man, just, you know, just for the memory, just for the reflection of it kind of thing. And, cause man, I grew up working so hard and so poor, my goodness. But man, it's the best era of my life. It's those first 18 years.
It's cool, man. Biggest business or personal win?
Well, without not including family, I mean, it's just Trisha. I love that woman, man. Her and I are one, you know. I just love her to pieces, man. Love Garth too. And I could listen to that woman sing every day of my life. I have played She's in Love with a Boy thousands and thousands of times, right? That was her very first year. And every time she sings it, man, she just kills me, you know? You're supposed to get tired of those songs. With her, man, there's not a thing that I've ever gotten tired of playing or listening to, you know? So, yeah, it's her. I hope Garth doesn't get too upset because I'm putting her over you, dude.
No, I mean, if you got to put somebody over somebody, their wife is okay. You know, that's I think people cut you slack. I would. I'm sure you would. It sounds like you've really done a great job listening to the universe, God, whoever, but you've really done it because it seems like all the things you've done, not all the things because we all have failures and setbacks, but it seems like a lot of the things you've done, you are, you're like spiritually and emotionally exactly where you're supposed to be.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
That's absolutely, man. You know, I pray a lot, you know, I'm also of that mindset that, you know, you don't get given anything, right? You know, if you're praying for a situation, all I do is pray that I can really work hard at this thing and hopefully achieve. But I don't pray that I get this for nothing. No, not, no, man. You know, I just pray that I'll do my best at this.
Yeah.
Ever, whatever it is, you know, whether it's a family matter, whether it's business, whether it's playing my guitar, whether it's another, you know, also investing mining industry in Canada. So whatever it is that I'm doing, you know, I just, I try to be smart about it and really work my ass off, man, every day of my life. When you and I get done here, I got to finish mixing two songs today. But yeah, man.
You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Hobbies. It used to be golf, but that's not even a hobby. That's recreation. Well, let's just say this. My wife and I, we love to build shit, man. I mean, she's as handy as I am. We love construction. Like I say, I built most of this house myself, you know. We love to build things. We love to remodel things. You know, we love a hammer in our hand kind of thing. That's what we do, man, you know. So, yeah, if I got a little bit of free time here and there, you know, we build garden beds, we build whatever, decks, patios, gazebos, you name it. We love building stuff. Yeah. So that's what we have the most fun with. And now that the kids are gone, man, now we actually go to the bar and act like we're dating again.
Dude, I'm with you on that, man. Isn't that great?
It's awesome.
Man. I know. I feel very lucky that we're, you know, we hung in there and everything was cool and we actually like each other, man. That's a gift, I think. It's a lucky position to be in. Johnny, toughest decision you've ever had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Man, I don't look at anything that I've ever had to do as a tough decision or difficult, even if it was difficult or tough. Again, it doesn't matter what I'm faced with, you know. I will, if it's a challenge, I will face the challenge and I will win. I mean, someday, you know, that might not be the case, but so far, I mean, the decision to come to Nashville to audition for Trisha is the best decision I've ever made, you know, musically, obviously, right? Sure. My career. But no, man, it's just, anything that comes my way that might be a tough situation or a challenge of some sort, I just face it. Look it square in the eye and just deal with it. Get it done.
It's like next.
Yeah.
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 Hey, man, and last question, and thank you very much for everything, man. You've like shared some really nice, heartwarming stuff. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change you think has been intentional and how much has just been a function of aging?
Man, definitely the last 10 years, the one thing that I'm actually very superstitious of, actually, maybe that's not even the right word, is what I know as a musician I have to pass on now. Like, for instance, I never have a minute off in a week usually. If I'm in town, it's even – if I'm touring, it's easier, right? But if I'm in town, you know, because of my businesses and studio world and all that stuff, I don't have any time off. But if a kid comes up to me – I say kid, could be a, you know, full-grown musician – and asks me for a guitar lesson, for instance, I don't care how busy I am. I'm going to give it to him because I have to pass on. Somebody passed it on to me. You know, if a young songwriter or young artist is asking me for advice, I do everything I can to help them because, you know, somebody opened the door for me. That was Craig Langford way back in the day when he called me to audition for Trisha, right?
Your bass player friend. Yeah.
And so, it's really important for me to help other people in the music industry. I can't shut a door for anybody, you know, kind of thing. So lately, you know, in the last few years, I mean, I'm very compelled, and it's important for me to pass on what I know and how to make a musician or an artist even better than they think they could ever be, you know, kind of thing. So yeah, I'm real passionate about that sort of thing.
That's right.
I might get asked, you know, thousands of times.
You may get a bunch of freaking emails now if people be hitting you up on, hey, I heard your interview with Craig and I have some questions.
You can't say no to a guitar lesson. And you're not going to take any money either.
What are you doing Thursday at about 5:30?
I guess giving you a lesson, right?
Dude, thank you very much for everything. I really enjoyed this. I'm glad we finally got to connect. Man, thank you for sharing all this stuff. I'm really happy to hear and for you to share the road you went on. It's extremely inspiring, and you should be proud of yourself. I know you are. I know you don't look at it as pride. You look at it as like just shit you had to do, and I get that. But thank you, man. It was really cool. And I just want to tell everybody, come check out Johnny. He's out with Trisha. Trisha Yearwood for the next, you said, 2 years? It's a big, long tour.
Yeah, I've been with Garth the last 20. I've been with her the last 28. Mm. But she's out doing her own tour now, so I'll probably be doing more of that than doing the Garth thing. But with that said, you know, I might do some of both kind of thing if it's doable kind of thing. So I love playing for both of them, man. It's been amazing to play with Garth and her. And at worst, I'll be back with Garth in a couple of years when Trisha's tour's over, kind of thing. You know,
very
that's
cool.
What we agreed on. But he said, unless he's pissed off because he doesn't like whoever.
Well, man, hopefully you come down this way and I get to connect with you.
Let listeners Strat story real quick.
Yeah, definitely.
And then I'm out of here. In the 80s, I'm down in South Texas. I could say I had an electric company. We had a service call in an old farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere. And all my guys were out working another job site, so I had to go do this one. And this old guy lived there by himself in a house, you know, probably 800 square feet. And it had a crawl space underneath the house, you know, was about a foot. And back then I was skinny as hell. I looked like Bruce Lee or something. I had to run a circuit for he had a gas stove, a gas range, and they got him an electric range. So I had to run a circuit underneath the house, you know, pop it through the floor and put a receptacle there to connect the range to, right? But as I was going underneath the floor, man, about 7 or 8 feet deep into the house, crawling on, you know, on my belly, like slithering like a snake down there because it was so tight, I ran into a Strat.
Underneath the house?
Underneath the house. A sunburst Strat. It was out of the case. It was there sitting there covered in dirt. I'm going, what the hell?
That's crazy, man.
So I backtracked with it and, you know, got it out from underneath the house and then just laid it there on the grass. And then I went back in and finished the work I had to do in 20 minutes. And then I come inside the house. The old guy's in a wheelchair. I come inside the house and I said, sir, this is in Spanish. He was Mexican dude. I said, sir, you know that there was an electric guitar underneath your house? And he says, huh? And he says, oh, those little motherfuckers. I guess his grandkids would come in there and plug this guitar in the nap. And it would annoy the shit out of him. So he found a way to get outside and yank, while the kids were gone, and yank this guitar under the house. And so I said, sir, I said, would you like to sell it? And he says, well, how much is this job you just did? I said, $75. How about we just trade? Yes, sir. So I took the Strat, right? Cleaned it up. It was a 61.
And holy shit.
The next day, dude, I'm playing at this bar in South Texas, and this one girl, what was her name? My goodness, Kim. I knew her and stuff, and she walks in with a case to my gig, right? We took a break, and she opened it up. She used to call me Dimps because I have a dimple.
You do. You have Dimps. One dimple.
He says, I've been meaning to get this to you forever, and I just finally brought it to you. And he said, used to belong to my ex-boyfriend, but we've been broken up for years and he doesn't want it. And I thought maybe you should have it. And I opened the case. It's another sunburst. This was a 62 Strat, right?
So you're getting like inheriting these Strats.
And I said, Kim, I said, maybe I'll be glad to buy it for you. She says, no, I don't know if I should say this or not. She said, all you need to do is make love to me.
Wow. Twist my arm.
Really? Seriously, yeah, twist my arm, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's day two, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 61 and a 62. The next day, day three, a friend of mine named Henry comes into the same bar I was at. We were like the house band, carrying a case. And I saw him come in the front door. And he says, man, Johnny, this belongs to my brother. He's in prison. And man, he needs some money for the commissary real bad. Man, opens the case, and dude, it's a 63 Strat.
He said, all you need to do is make love to him and give it to him.
That's how much money you want for this thing, dude? You know, well, man, he just needs money for the commissary, man. He's still got another 3 years to go, you know? And I said, how about, I don't know, $500, $600? What do you want? And this was in the 80s, right? So right before the crazy,
yeah,
you know, just market skyrocketed. Fender guitars. Said, no, man, just give me $125.
Holy.
And so I'm like, a friend of mine had a guitar shop down there. I took him to him like the next day, and he verified that it was 61, 62, 63. He makes a phone call to what was the big music store in Dallas? Shoot. So anyway, that guy, the owner of the store, comes in the next day and without seeing the guitars writes me a $15,000 check. And I'm like,
Wow.
Man, I don't know. I don't want to sell him. And he makes it out for $17,000. And I'm like, wait a second. There's something here that I don't know about. So I sold it. I unfortunately sold the freaking guitars to him. And the next day, he sold them for $40,000. The three of them.
Wow.
So then that's when I'm like, what is going on? And that's when that whole, you know, crazy skyrocket value of Fender guitar started.
Dude, that is the craziest, craziest story I've ever heard.
It's so out there, man. It's like,
yeah, it's way out. Oh my God. That is like, what is the chances statistically of something like three guitars, three strats?
Days, yeah.
That's crazy, man. What a great story.
Just for the audience to know, me and the girl did not hook up, even though.
Oh, you did not?
No, she was a hottie. And she was a hottie.
Good man.
Well, I would have had to cheat on somebody to do pull that off.
Oh, you know? I hear you, man. You can't do that. Well, dude, hang on one second. Let me just say goodbye to everybody and thank you for everything. I really appreciate it. Great story to end with, man. Very cool. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Johnny Garcia for spending time with us. Go out and check out Johnny with Trisha and or Garth on the road. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.